Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see you all again. It's just been a little over a month since I was here last, and you are as friendly as ever. We really enjoy coming here. It's a small but vibrant group of people, so thank you for the warm welcome we've already received and looking forward to spending time with you today. To begin this message, I would like to read from an article in The Guardian entitled "Why the Modern World is Bad for Your Brain," from the January 18th, 2015 edition. Our brains are busier than ever before. We're assaulted with facts, pseudo-facts, jibber-jabber, and rumor all posing as information. Trying to figure out what you need to know and what you can ignore is exhausting. At the same time, we're all doing more. 30 years ago, travel agents made all our airline and rail reservations. Salespeople helped us find what we were looking for in shops, and professional typists or secretaries helped busy people with their correspondence. Now we do most of these things ourselves. We are doing the jobs of 10 different people while still trying to keep up with our lives, our children, our parents, our friends, our careers, our hobbies, and our favorite TV shows. The article continues. Our smartphones have become Swiss Army knives, like appliances that include a dictionary, calculator, web browser, email, Game Boy, appointment calendar, voice recorder, guitar tuner, weather forecast, GPS, texters, tweeter, Facebook updater, and flashlight. They are more powerful and do more things than the most advanced computer at IBM corporate headquarters just 30 years ago. And we use them all the time, part of our 21st century mania for cramming everything we do into every spare moment of downtime. And just a break from the article, you can see that, like when you're at the airport, everybody's got their phones open and texting or doing something. Or when I'm at meetings, sometimes you can see people looking at their phones trying to keep up with emails. Going back to the article, we text while we're walking across the street, catch up on email, we stand in a queue, and we have lunch with friends, we serendipitously check to see what our other friends are doing. At the kitchen counter, cozy and secure in our domicile, we are writing our shopping list on smartphones while we are listening to that wonderfully informative podcast on urban beekeeping. But there's a fly in the ointment. Although we think we're doing several things at once, multitasking, this is a powerful and diabolical illusion. Earl Miller, a neuroscientist at MIT and one of the world's experts on divided attention, says that our brains are not wired to multitask well. When people think they're multitasking, they're actually just switching from one task to another very rapidly. And every time they do, there's a cognitive cost in doing so. So we're not actually keeping a lot of balls in the air like an expert juggler. We're more like a bad amateur plate spinner, frantically switching from one task to another. Ignoring that the one not right in front of us, but worried about they all will come crashing down at any moment. Even though we think we're getting a lot done, ironically, multitasking makes us demonstrably less efficient. I would like to also right now read from a draft paper that was written on April 12, 2002 to be submitted to the Information Society, which is a peer review academic journal for sociologists. And it is entitled, the paper, "Complexity and Information Overload in Society: Why Increasing Efficiency Leads to Decreasing Control." And this is the abstract I'll read from. It is argued that social and technological evolution is characterized by the ephemeralization and an accelerating increase in the efficiency of all material, energetic, and information processes. This leads to the practical disappearance of the constraints of space, time, matter, and energy, and thus spectacularly increases our power to physically solve problems. However, the accompanying lubrication or reduction of friction in all processes creates a number of non-physical problems characterized by the increasing instability, complexity, and reach of causal networks, and therefore decreasing controllability and predictability. As a result, individuals are forced to consider more information and opportunities than they can effectively process. This information overload is made worse by data smog, the proliferation of low-quality information because of easy publication. It leads to anxiety, stress, alienation, and potentially dangerous errors of judgment. I'd like to repeat that. Dangerous errors of judgment with all the information we're receiving today. Moreover, it holds back overall economic productivity. Now, though this draft paper was written 10 years ago, the words are ever more true today. Just because it's on the internet, just because it's in the newspapers, just because it's on television, does not mean that the vast quantity of information we're receiving is accurate. It does not mean it's not without its flaw. It does not mean it's not imperfect. Just because it's on the internet doesn't make it right. We have a lot of data smog out there. We live in a society of overload, and this was predicted for the world in the end times. Turn to Daniel 12, verse 4. Daniel 12, verse 4. Daniel 12, verse 4 states, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." One commentary notes the following. The phrase "to and fro" is not to be limited to people literally going from one place to another. While it also does mean that, the word in Hebrew indicates something that is happening entirely within a person's mind. The minds of the people are casting back and forth as though they are in the midst of a puzzle, a mystery, an enigma they cannot figure out. Or they are all stressed and their minds are flashing back and forth because all that is burdening them. So thus, at the end times of what Daniel's pointing out, there's a lack of balance, an instability to decide true values, an artificiality of life, an outlook that's contrary to nature. People are trying to find truth, but there's so much knowledge, and many times incorrect knowledge out there, that they're confused. In a message I gave a few months ago in Los Angeles, I discussed the roles of our roles to be an ambassador of Christ. And I focused on 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20, if we would turn there. What I'm going to do is give you a brief summary of that message because it ties into this message today. This message is effectively a follow-through of that. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20. It states in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20, "Therefore we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God." And then the message that I will summarize right now, I quoted from the Embassy of the United States in Ottawa, Canada. And within that website, it had a discussion on what a role of ambassador and what the 8 responsibilities of an ambassador were. And for the purpose of the message I was given, I focused on 3 of those, and I'd like to bring those up today and their application for us today. The website first said, "An ambassador speaks with one voice to others on U.S. policy." And what the message I brought forth to everyone, as ambassadors for Christ, we have the mind of Christ and speak the same thing. Not just saying the same words, but having the mind of Christ so deeply in our lives that we need to understand and believe the same. Secondly, an ambassador, from the website again, an ambassador carefully uses mission resources through regular reviews of program, personnel, and funding levels. And that applies to us as ambassadors for Christ. We're to treasure the resources we have, our relationship with God, His Spirit working in our lives, His Word, and members of His family. And finally, the website noted that an ambassador serves Americans with professional excellence, the highest standards of ethical conduct, and diplomatic discretions. And as ambassadors for Christ, we are to have the highest standards. We are to practice diplomacy with one another. We are people of excellence. With this in mind, that the admonition that we are to be ambassadors for Christ, I would like to focus on a key component of being an ambassador of Christ to this world. Without it, we cannot properly perform our duties. Without it, we cannot properly represent God's kingdom to this world. And this component is found in 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. 2 Timothy 1, verse 7 says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." The interlinear Greek New English New Testament defines the Greek word for sound mind, which is only used here in all the scriptures, as wise discretion. Other versions describe the Greek word as self-discipline, self-control, sound judgment, good judgment, temperance. Stability or sound-mindedness is one of the keys of Paul's writings as to the stability of faith and expectation. He adds to his message in Timothy the stability of mind. Sound-mindedness, something that will result in clear and an unobstructed outlook in the affairs of our present life as well as our spiritual concern. Paul does not only address this attribute in that particular scripture we're looking at in Timothy, but others as well. Let's turn to Titus 2. Titus 2, this idea of having sound-mindedness. Titus 2, verse 3, "Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, and self-controlled." Or the Holman Christian Standard Bible states, "Older men are to be level-headed, worthy of respect, sensible, sound in faith, love, and endurance." Titus 2, verse 5. Just go down to verse 5. "Older women are to teach younger women to be self-controlled." In other words, other versions note the word for self-controlled to be discreet, sensible, using good judgment, industrious. And if go down to verse 6, young men are to be self-controlled. And other versions note the term as live wisely, sensible, discreet, sober-minded. So the idea of sound-mindedness applies to all of us. It's not limited to one group or another. We are all to be sound-minded. And in this epistle, stability of mind is something that we really need at this time when we go through and look at the affairs of this present life. When we see the world around us exploding, we need sound-mindedness. And our world is not, whether globally, nationally, regionally, and individually, is not stable. Instability is all around us. The battle for our minds, the battle for our thoughts is fierce, especially for our young people, our teens and young adults. There is a battle for your mind going out there. And society is trying to convince all of us, but especially the youth, to their way of thinking is the right way. Whether liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, religious or secular, and the contrasts go on, there is a battle for our minds. And the volume and the intensities of these entreats can be daunting. And it can cause us to be destabilized in our thought process. It can cause us to be confused, even lost in our journey. And there is a general lack of sound-mindedness among mankind. There is a lack of balance. There's a lack of ability to decide true values. And thus, life becomes artificial. Rules become arbitrary. And it's confusing. It's destabilizing. And it can impact us, especially for our young people. It can definitely impact them at this time because they're much more internet savvy than we are. And they are. And it's amazing when I see young people with the internet, with their phones, and their minds are constantly going, taking in all sorts of information. They are being challenged. Having a sound mind is our key to our role in being an ambassador for Christ. Now, let's go back to 2 Timothy 1, verse 7 again, real briefly. 2 Timothy 1, verse 7. Now, Paul is stating that the Spirit of God is not one of fear, but of power, of love, and for purposes of this message, of a sound mind. So Paul is contrasting fear with that of a sound mind. What fears do we have that cause us not to have a sound mind? In the case of Timothy, he was timid, and it caused problems. He was fearful. He was timid. But what are our fears? And as much as we hate to admit it, society plays on our fears. Maybe it's the fear of not having what we deserve. Maybe the fear of not achieving the American dream. Maybe we're fearful of other cultures in our society. Maybe your fear of not having enough. Fear of losing what we have. Fear of not being a success. Fear of being a failure. Fear that someone will not like us. Fear that someone will like us. And with all the information in our hands, we could become confused by it all and potentially swayed by it all and become people of unsound minds. At times, this fear can cause us to be worried, stressed, anxious, and discouraged, and we can become to lose our focus, become distracted, become destabilized. With this as background, I'd like to explore three principles for us to consider in achieving a sound mind. And I want to introduce these principles by phrases you're probably familiar with. And these phrases, as we analyze them, will go to a principle I'm trying to get across with these. So the first phrase that I would like us to consider in achieving a sound mind is garbage in, garbage out. Garbage in, garbage out. During my tenure in public accounting, we had a phrase with this phrase when we used it with preparation of tax returns. Garbage in, garbage out. In other words, the work we could perform and the services we could provide our client were only as good as the information we could receive. They're only as good as the information as the client gave to us. If the information was incomplete, the return would be incomplete. Thus, we had to work very closely with our clients to make sure we had all the correct information necessary to produce an accurate return. Otherwise, what would happen? It'd be incomplete, inaccurate. It would be garbage. Are we allowing incomplete information in our minds? Young people, are you allowing incomplete information into your minds? Are we allowing bias, emotions, conjecture to cloud our understanding? If we do, then our thoughts, our actions, our thinking will be incomplete, inaccurate. It is garbage in, garbage out. Turn to Philippians 4, verse 8. Philippians 4, verse 8. Philippians 4, verse 8. It states in Philippians 4, verse 8, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence," and remember, we are to be people of excellence, "if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." So what things do we allow in our minds? Is what we see on the internet or televisions or things we say or do with people we associate with it with true, or is it biased? Is it honorable or maybe a little less than? Is it just or one-sided? Is it pure or flawed? Is it lovely or dark? Is it commendable or a bit embarrassing? Is it based upon excellence or mediocrity? Is it worthy of praise or something to be hidden? If we are to be sound-minded, we must be guardians of our minds. We must watch what we allow into our minds, what we think about. And it takes work. It takes discernment and discipline to set our minds on the right things. It takes personal effort. Turn to Proverbs 4, verse 20. Proverbs 4, verse 20. And I would like to, as we turn, I'd like to read from the New Living Translation. And for this particular set of scriptures I'll be reading, I think it's a little easier to understand. It's clearer. So New Living Translation, Proverbs 4, verse 20. And young people, I ask you to really listen to this and take these to heart. I was a young person in the church as well, so I remember sitting in church. Sometimes I pass notes. I'm guilty. One time I had the minister, actually, we were passing notes. Okay, I'm sidetracking off the message. And we were passing notes. And then we had four of us sitting together, and the minister stopped services, had us all stand up and go back with our parents. I always told my kids I would never do that to them. And I never did. I was humiliated. My parents, well, needless to say, I don't remember what my father said to me that night, but I'm sure it wasn't good. Proverbs 24, verse 20. It says, "My child, pay attention to what I say. Listen carefully to my words. Do not lose sight of them. Let them penetrate deep into your heart, for they bring life to those who find them and healing to their whole body." And the verse I really want us to focus on, especially young people, verse 23, "Guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life." Once again, guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life. The heart in Hebrew is a term that means feelings and will, basically your intellect. In other words, your thoughts. And what Proverbs is saying, guard your thoughts, because it will determine the course of your life. So how are we doing? The second phrase that I would like us to consider in achieving a sound mind is, life is not fair. Life is not fair. Now, for those of us who have been in the church for a while, this may be a familiar phrase. When I came to Ambassador College in Pasadena in the 70s, I remember hearing Art McCarroll. He was a minister who in a sermon stated, "Life is not fair." And that stuck with me. And he's explained it that sometimes things in life that just happen are not fair. And we can think of circumstances where this is true. We could think of a child who's born with a birth defect. What did the child do to deserve that? Or cancer to a child. Is that fair? When someone has let go from job due to economic hard times, they've worked hard, they put their heart into their jobs, but they were let go. And they have a family support. Is that fair? When someone runs the red light and hits our car, we're obeying the rules, but they run the light, hit our car. Is that fair? And we can come up with many more situations and scenarios. Life is just at times not fair. And it's important to understand this and accept this if we're going to have sound minds. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11, it says, "Again, I saw under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor the riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all." One of the most frustrating lessons I think we have to learn in our journey, in our walk in this life, is that physical life is just not fair. And we have to have an eternal perspective on life, God's perspective. This physical life will not be fair. And sometimes we want it to be fair, and it clouds our judgment and clouds our sound-mindedness. And we know we get frustrated at times. It's irritating to us that justice is not served when the righteous suffer, when the one who has done the wrong gets away with it and not dealt with that blow of justice. It's not always the case in this life, and we live in a very imperfect world, that justice is not always served. Sometimes life is just not fair, and justice in this physical life is just not served. That is not how it should be, but that is just the way it is. Unfairness and injustice does happen. The key is, how do we respond to such situations? Do we have the emotional maturity or the soundness of mind to accept those things in life that are just not fair and move forward, realizing that we are all part of, all of us, young people and old, are part of something greater than the here and now? Turn to Galatians 6, verse 7. Galatians 6, verse 7. It states in Galatians 6, verse 7, "Do not be deceived, God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he will also reap. For one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but one who sows to the Spirit will reap eternal life. Then let us not lose heart in doing good. For in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary." And obviously when we see that life is unfair, we can become weary. But it says here, don't become weary. So then, when we all have the opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Paul notes here that as we see the events of life, we should not be deceived, we should not be discouraged, we should not grow weary. Challenges of life can cause this to happen. We are reminded that there's something more than the here and now, and not to focus, and we are to focus what's on the eternal and not become discouraged when life isn't fair. But what is the antidote? If life is not fair, what does Paul say is the antidote? Do good. Get the mind off yourself. Go and do good. That's the antidote to others. It takes the mind off ourselves and our discouragement by the unfairness of life. We look outward rather than inward. Now, I'm not saying that everything that happens to us in life is unfair. Sometimes we pay a price for making mistakes. That's part of life as well. If we don't save for retirement when we become retired, we might not have enough funds to retire easily. Or if we don't get a marketable skill or an education when we're young, that we may have challenges later financially in life. What I'm saying is, though, even when we find ourselves in this kind of situation, will we have the emotional maturity to deal with it? Or will we allow ourselves to spin out of control, become angry, hurt, despondent, which impacts our ability to have a sound mind? The third aspect of obtaining a sound mind is actually in the form of a phrase, a question. Third one that I would like to consider in achieving a sound mind is the glass half empty or half full? It's been said that Ben Franklin was once asked if he was an optimist or a pessimist. He replied, "I'm a pessimist. The optimist is too often disappointed. A pessimist is at least occasionally pleasantly surprised." Now, that may be the saving grace for pessimists to hold on to thoughts, to hang on to the negative side of things. Hopefully that something good will happen. But there's another adage that also goes, "Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst." That's one, that way one is ready for things to happen. People who see a glass is half full are more likely to be satisfied and not see the need to make changes. Conversely, however, they may fail to make changes. They focus on the fact that the glass is half empty, and then they waste their time bemoaning the fact. So whether we are optimistic, we think the glass is half full, we may not change. But if we are pessimistic and we see the glass is half empty, we may not change either because it's beyond our control. Maybe we know somebody like that. Maybe it's ourselves. But clearly both points of view can be helpful in looking at a situation. Clearly, both are needed for a clear picture. Here's the reality. The glass is both half empty and half full. Despite the appearances, the question of half empty or half full is not simple, and nor does it have a simple answer. It's a question about perception. How do we perceive the glass? In reality, how do we perceive a situation? And how our perception is and how we perceive the world has a lot to do with our lives. And no one perception will suffice, will it? There are times we see the world through rose-colored glasses. We're Pollyanna-ish, and life is just plain wonderful. And then there are other times when we're all gloom and doom because life, that's how life is going for us. There are times of joy when we appreciate what we are and what we've done, and the times we have our challenges and our trials that force us to face up what needs to be done. There are times when our perception is filtered through specific concerns, and everything revolves around that one concern, whether our goals are being inhibited, whether our feelings are hurt, whether our challenges that we're challenged, whether our children, maybe it's our health, whether our children's health, how they're doing. And sometimes we can take a more detached view. It's good to take on both perspectives, in other words, with balance. The more ways we can see a situation from different perspectives, the better our decision-making process will be. The world is not a simple place, and it's difficult for us to have a complete and true picture of it by ourselves. Turn to Proverbs 15, verse 22. With this in mind, this is why Proverbs brings this particular point up. Proverbs 15, verse 22. It says, without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed. In other words, we can come up with a better decision, a better understanding when we involve others, when we involve counsel. And what does that bring to the table? People with different perspectives, people with different views. And sometimes the counsel you'll bring in will be a half-empty view, and others will be a half-full view. But with getting all that information, we'll come to a sound judgment, a sound decision. By combining perceptions, we can gain clarity and come up with a sound decision. One of the things I mentioned at work, when people I were dealing with situations regarding some of our departments and our department chairs, is I will say perception is reality. Now, people say, what do you mean by that? Well, it's not the reality, but in the person's mind, the person with the perception, that is their form of reality. If they feel they've been dealt unjustly, and that's their perception, that's their reality, right? Even though it may be fair what was done, its perceptions are really key into understanding reality. And that's why when we go out and seek counsel and get other perceptions, that's why we go out and seek encouragement of one another, it can help us get a true view of what is going on. We need both a half-empty and a half-full perspective when evaluating situations. The glass can be seen in many different ways. The real question is, what are we doing with the glass and its contents? Christ addresses this point when he tells his disciples in John 7, verse 24. He states, do not judge by appearances, or if I may add, by our own perspective, but judge with right judgment. Once again, I'll read that. Do not judge by appearances or by our perspective, but judge with right judgment. So what is right judgment? Turn to Romans 2, verse 2. Romans 2, verse 2. It states, we know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. And Young's literal translation renders the scriptures as follows. And we know that the judgment of God is according to truth to those who practice such things. Righteous judgment is having the truth. It's having all the facts. It's seeing matters not from whether the glass is half empty or half full, but seeing the glass and the contents for what it is. In our ever-increasing, fast-paced world, the need for sound-mindedness is much more acute. We are more and more bombarded with thoughts and ideas. There's a battle for each and every one of our minds. In seeking a sound mind, we need to review the three action items, three considerations, by examining the phrases that are familiar. Each of these phrases encompassed a principle. For example, the phrase garbage in, garbage out points to the principle that we need to guard our minds. The phrase life is not fair points to the principle we need to be realistic about events in this physical life and actions in this physical life, the here and now, against something far greater, the plan of God. And the phrase, which was in the form of the question, is the glass half empty or half full, points to the principles that we need to look at situations with all the facts, the truth, not to judge on emotion, but to know what the facts are, to get different perspectives, to seek counsel, and to seek righteous judgment, to seek truth in approaching and analyzing situations. The bottom line is we need to transform our thinking and transform our mind. Turn to Romans 12, verse 1. Romans 12, verse 1. Romans 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your body a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. It's proving, not just accepting, not just reading things on the internet and assuming they're accurate. It's proving. God's Spirit is not one of fear, but of a sound mind. That is the nature of God's Spirit. But as Scripture shows, we have an action item. There's something we need to do. We need to prove what is good and acceptable. We just do not allow thoughts and ideas to come in our mind with the hope that God's Spirit will just somehow decide for us what is good and not. We need to prove. We need to take the time to think and evaluate what we are listening to, what we are hearing, and what we are evaluating. We need to guard our thinking to keep a proper perspective on this physical life and to seek truth and righteous judgment when evaluating a matter. We use these principles to determine what is good and what is acceptable so we are not conformed to this world's thinking. There's so much going on around us. Knowledge is everywhere. We need to filter what comes into our minds, or it can, and actually it will, destabilize us. We accomplish this by prayer, meditation, fasting, and using our compass, the Bible. The Bible is our compass. When we are bombarded and struggling to find our way, we need to take our compass, and if you all know, my three sons were all Boy Scouts, when you're out hiking, the compass points you to north. You can always tell that needle where due north is, and then you can find your path. The Bible helps us find the true path, the words within the Bible. As ambassadors for Christ, having a sound mind is as necessary as we represent God and His kingdom on this earth. We need to be guardians of our minds and our thoughts to be sure they conform with the acceptable and perfect will of God. This is the key to being sound-minded.